Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Not long ago, the Kauffman Interfaith Institute, of which IDA is a program affiliate, hosted Eboo Patel, founder and president of Interfaith Youth Corps here in Grand Rapids. His visit included two lectures, one at Aquinas College and one here at Grand Valley State University. Both were packed houses, filled with campus and community members. Eboo's sessions spoke to the importance of interfaith leadership in our increasingly diverse communities, and he provided personal insights on everything from his experiences as a Muslim to Pope Francis' recent U.S. visit. During his visit, he met with student leaders, Aquinas and GVSU presidents, staff and faculty from both of the institutions. Themes of those conversations included not only interfaith leadership development, but also inclusion, intersectionality, and rooting interfaith engagement in our college missions. So please sit back and enjoy a lecture from Eboo Patel here on Common Threads.
Thank you so much. I am thrilled to be here. Yeah, you folks in West Michigan know how to keep people busy. I've had all kinds of fun. There's been no lack of intellectual conversation and great interaction. I love this place, Grand Valley State. You ought to be really proud of what you have built here. I also love Hope College. Shall I tell a Hope College story? All right. So this must be 10 years ago, and I've been married. I'm recently married. Married 1 or 2 years, and recently birthed Interfaith Youth Corps. And I'm not a very balanced person at the time. And the birth of Interfaith Youth Corps is crowding out the marriage in my life. And my wife is telling me, you better take me away for a weekend. And you better not mention the word interfaith. You better not say the words Martin Marty or Jane Addams or Dorothy Day or any variety of interfaith leaders you might have been inspired by. You better just focus on Shanaz Mansouri this weekend. We choose the beautiful state of Michigan for our weekend getaway. We're in Holland or South Haven or something. I actually focus 36 hours on my wife. I'm feeling like a very good husband. It is Sunday at the bed and breakfast. I'm flipping through the local paper and I stop. I freeze. And my wife's like, what? And I'm like, baby, how much do you love me? And she's like, this better not be. And I'm like, Jim Wallace is preaching at Hope College at 11 a.m. Can we go? She's like, there are going to be a lot of diamonds you need to pay for this over the course of the next 10 years. But she is wonderful. We went, and then Jim Wallace got banned from our house for the next 5 years. I could no longer say the name, but we went to Hope College. You all know who Jim Wallace is? Oh, you need to know who Jim Wallace is. That's the next lesson for the Hope College Honors Program. So Jim Wallace is one of the great Christian social action heroes of our time and was an early mentor to me in interfaith work. I actually took a pilgrimage to visit the office at Sojourners when I was living in Catholic worker houses in the summer of 1995. And he wasn't at the office, and his assistant said, Jim Wallace is only here one day this month. He's on book tour. He's only here one day. He's at his house doing laundry, and he's getting back on the road tomorrow. I'm like, where does he live? And I went and I sat on his porch, and I made him come talk to me. So if you want to know what obsessive looks like, you have the picture in the dictionary when it comes to obsessive about interfaith work. So my goal here is to make you a little bit more obsessive about interfaith work in the course of this talk and conversation. I actually want to begin with a set of snapshots of American life. First snapshot. Last year, about this time in the NFL season, the New England Patriots are in Kansas City playing the Chiefs. Hussein Abdullah, the great defensive back of the Chiefs, who has recently done Hajj, took off an entire NFL season to go do Hajj. That's how important his Muslim faith was to him. Has an inkling in the locker room before the game that the Chiefs were going to play great, and he was going to play great. And he thinks to himself, if I get a pick six tonight off of Tom Brady, I'm going to do a Muslim prayer in the end zone. Second half, that's exactly what happens. He catches Brady off at about midfield, runs it back, 6 points, and he goes down, forehead and nose to the ground, in the Sijda al-Shukr, the prayer of thanksgiving. The ref pulls a yellow flag and gives him 15 yards. Excessive celebration. Did you ever see Tim Tebow get flagged for excessive celebration? No. There's a prayer exemption, a religious exception to that rule. You can pray as a matter of celebrating. It's in the NFL rule books. So why did Hussein Abdullah get flagged? The next day, the NFL Referees Association apologized. The referee didn't know what Mr. Abdullah was doing, was prayer. If you are an NFL ref, heck, if you're a college ref, I promise you, the athletes you deal with are going to be religiously diverse. And they are going to pray before games, and they are going to stop for moments during games. When an athlete from either team gets injured, they might pray as a matter of celebration. And if a whole team prays, you might have an agnostic or an atheist who respectfully stands aside because that does not resonate with his particular connection to the universe. If you are a coach or a ref at any level, you are going to have to deal with religious diversity. I promise you, NFL refs this season know what Muslim prayer looks like. Scenario number two. A few months ago, terrible tragedy in New York City. Officer Wenjen Liu of the New York Police Department is killed in the line of duty. And as the NYPD prepares to say goodbye to one of its fallen brothers, and they have the person who arranges funerals, visit with the family, they discover something. Mr. Liu is not an Italian or an Irish Catholic, as many members of the force are. He is not accustomed, his family is not accustomed to funerals that are held in quiet, large churches, full of officers in pressed Navy uniforms and dignitaries coming to the microphone, the mayor, the commissioner of police, and giving long speeches. His family is accustomed to small, loud, mournful goodbyes to their loved ones. They are accustomed to wailing and sobbing openly with a picture of the departed placed in the center of the room, garlanded with flowers. They take paper money and throw it at the picture to ensure the prosperity and security of the departed in the afterlife. Wenjin Liu was a Chinese Buddhist, and this is how his family, his religion, mourns their dead. Well, you can imagine the challenge that presented the New York Police Department, because those officers also wanted to mourn somebody they considered a brother in arms. So what do you do if you are the person who arranges the funerals? Well, in one case, I guess you do both. But what if the family is so in mourning, so deep in grief, that they don't want to come to the traditional Roman Catholic funeral? If you work for the New York Police Department, you better know how to do funerals for a range of religious traditions. Heck, if you work for the Grand Rapids or the Detroit or the Chicago or the Holland Police Department, your police officers are no longer just a single religion. They're going to start looking like the religious diversity of this country. Scenario number three, from a great book called The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. Anybody know this book? It's a book about a Hmong family, H-M-O-N-G. The Hmong are mountain people from Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, allies of the United States in the Vietnam War in the 1960s and early 1970s. As gratitude for that, the United States resettles several hundred thousand of them here in the Midwest, largely Minnesota and Wisconsin, and also out west. One family. Family of Leanne Lee, a little girl has a tragedy befall them. Or maybe a tragedy plus something else, depending on your religious perspective. Their one-year-old daughter, Leanne, starts to shake and convulse. Her eyes roll into the back of her head. She loses consciousness. This happens multiple times. The family takes her to the hospital. The doctors, I think the technical term is, freak out. There's a one-year-old girl having seizures. The doctors go immediately into emergency medical mode. They do everything you would imagine needs to be done in Western medicine for a one-year-old girl having seizures. But it doesn't fully connect with the family of Leanne Lee. Because the family of Leanne Lee are Hmong shamans. And the tradition, in the shaman tradition, suggests that our souls come from elsewhere. And occasionally they depart. They leave again. And they need to be recaptured. They need to be reimplanted in our bodies. And the person who can do that is a shaman, somebody who travels between the physical world and the material world. They looked at their daughter, Leanne, and they said, this isn't primarily a medical issue. This is primarily a spiritual issue. We need to sacrifice the right number of animals so that a shaman may travel to the spirit world, exchange the souls of these animals for the soul of our daughter, and plant it back in her body. This complicates things considerably because the family of Leanne Lee believes that the medicine that the doctors are giving her blocks her soul coming back into her body. So they no longer give Leanne this medicine. They are suspicious that the doctors continue to change the dosages. They are angry that the doctors never speak to them as adults. Angry that the doctors never do house calls. Angry that the doctors routinely ask invasive questions, that they draw blood, that putting somebody under is a routine practice in a Western hospital. If you lose consciousness in the Hmong tradition, the chance of your soul departing is even higher. Most of all, they are struck that the doctors do not seem to understand that in addition to there being a physical challenge, there is something perhaps spiritually magnificent happening. Because the way that the Hmong believe shamans are prepared is by seizures in their youth. Leanne needs to have her soul returned from the spirit world. That is a challenge, but it may be that the spirit world is preparing her for something magnificent. The spirit world might be preparing her to be one who one day exchanges souls, to be the most vaunted figure in the Hmong community, a shaman. The doctors, I think the technical way of understanding this, all of this just goes like this for them. They just don't get it at all. And they are eminently frustrated that this family refuses to give medicine to their 12, 15, 18-month-old daughter who is having seizures, to the point where they call in the child welfare system in the state of California, have police officers show up at the Lee's door and take Leanne away for 6 months because they say they are unfit as parents. The anthropologist who writes this book, you can see her fit of rage as she says, how can these doctors consider these parents unfit? Did they not know that they had used 3 months' salary to do a road trip across the United States to visit a shaman in his home in Minnesota? Did they not know that they had spent unbelievable amounts of money and family connections to bring herbs from the mountains of Laos and Cambodia here so that they could hang it in amulets around her neck? Did they not know how many animals were sacrificed in the courtyard of their apartment complex so that their souls could be traded?
You're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. Today, we are running part one of a lecture from the Interfaith Youth Corps founder, Eboo Patel. He gave this lecture here in Grand Rapids.
Those doctors were good Western doctors. They just had no idea of the spiritual tradition that the Lees came from. If you are a doctor in an American hospital, in this remarkable new hospital complex that is emerging in Grand Rapids, and you have a Hmong patient whose daughter is having a seizure, how will you understand their spiritual worldview in relation to that condition? Will you understand that making house visits matters in that community? Will you understand that perhaps changing the dosage on a weekly basis to get it right, as Western doctors are wont to do, creates more suspicion than it allays suspicion? Will you understand that maybe a seizure for them is both a physical challenge but also an opportunity for spiritual grace? Our hospitals are filled with Hmong shaman, Chinese Buddhist, Egyptian Muslim, Argentinian Pentecostal patients, all of whom might have interesting, unique, distinct spiritual and religious takes on a medical condition or a physical challenge. How you deal with that as a nurse or a doctor, I think, is central to your craft, is central to your profession. These are three scenarios in what is the religiously diverse democracy that is the United States of America. This country is the most religiously diverse nation in human history. That's a stunning fact. Think about that for a second. More people from more different religious orientations have gathered in this political entity than in any other political entity in human history. Unbelievable. The most religiously devout nation in the West. Even Donald Trump is asked if he's read the Bible. Let's put it that way. Right? In this country, people's rates of going to church, synagogue, temple, mosque, people's rates of saying grace before meals, people's rates of believing in God are dramatically higher than in European countries, Australia, or Canada. Most religiously diverse nation in human history, most religiously devout nation in the West at a time of global religious conflict. So, will American religious diversity in our school systems, in our hospitals, on our college campuses, in our police departments, on our athletic fields, begin to look like the blood and war that is religious diversity in too many other parts of the world? Or will America continue to forge a different kind of model? A model of interfaith cooperation. A model where people who orient around religion differently engage one another in ways characterized by bridges of understanding and cooperation. Listen, neither path is inevitable, right? People like to say that diversity is our strength. Multiculturalism ought to be celebrated. But there are many parts of the world that are diverse, in which diversity is clearly not a strength. There are many parts of the world where diversity is a civil war. How do we make sure that diversity in America is not characterized by bubbles of isolation, or by barriers of division, or by bludgeons of domination, but by bridges of cooperation? I think there's actually a very easy answer to that question. The easy answer is, we need to have a critical mass of bridge builders. Bridges don't fall from the sky. Bridges don't rise from the ground. People build them. People bring religious diversity together in conversations that highlight mutual enrichments rather than mutual exclusions. People create activities where others from diverse religious orientations can connect the deepest part of themselves to a common activity and therefore connect to one another. I think the hope for American religious diversity to forge a model of cooperation is a critical mass of interfaith bridge builders. That's why I love the Kauffman Institute so much. That's why I love this part of the country so much, because what this, 13 colleges in this West Michigan region are doing, what you all have done with Catholics and Jews and evangelical Christians and mainline Protestants and emerging Muslim community, what you all have done is special. Right? Your year of interfaith dialogue, your year of interfaith understanding, this is powerful. This is the kind of stuff that people all around the country come to look at and to learn from. And my highest hope from all of this is that you folks make a decision, a commitment to become an interfaith leader, to be the kind of person whose identity is tied up in building bridges of understanding between people who orient around religion differently, who look at the scenarios that I offered you, Hussein Abdullah of the Kansas City Chiefs, Wenjen Liu of the New York Police Department, Leanne Lee, that little Hmong girl in the hospital in Merced, California. And you think to yourself, if I was a doctor there, if I was a coach there, if I directed funeral arrangements for the NYPD, what would I do? How would I handle the situation? How would I be a builder of bridges of interfaith cooperation right there? Because I'll tell you, those are 3 of 3,000. These interfaith scenarios are only going to grow in America, and we're going to need a huge quantity of interfaith leaders to engage them. I want to highlight 3 skills that I see are essential to interfaith leadership. This is not primarily a thinking thing. This is primarily a doing thing. How do you do interfaith leadership well? Skill number 1, public narrative. Precisely what I went to see Jim Wallace for. The ability to tell a story that highlights the significance of interfaith cooperation. The ability to inspire folks about living into this vision. Howard Gardner, the great psychologist at Harvard, does a big study of leadership, publishes it in something called Leading Minds, and ultimately decides that leadership comes down to a single sentence. He says, what leaders do is tell a new story in the world and embody that story with their lives. And he goes through this range of leaders from Margaret Thatcher to Martin Luther King Jr. to Mahatma Gandhi and said each one of them, what they were able to do was to tell a new story to a constituency. In Thatcher's case, it was the United Kingdom. In Gandhi's case, it was occupied India. In Martin Luther King Jr.'s case, it was the United States. They told a new story about what the world could look like, and when people looked at them, they saw that world. They embodied it with their lives. What does it look like for you to develop the skills of public narrative when it comes to interfaith leadership? What does it look like for you to stand up and tell a story of people from different religious backgrounds working together in positive ways? I think a part of this is knowing the history of interfaith cooperation, knowing that in 1893 there was a great event in Chicago called the Parliament of the World's Religions. In 10 days at Salt Lake City, there will be a reprisal of that event. Every 5 years, there's another Parliament of the World's Religions, this notion of lifting up a mass conference that lifts up the inspiring nature of interfaith cooperation. And the final line of the Parliament of the World's Religions in 1893, spoken by Charles Bonney, was, from now on, the great religions of the world make war no longer on each other and instead on the giant ills that afflict humankind. How do you weave historic stories like that with your own personal story? Your own personal story of how you've been inspired by people or ideas from other religious traditions. Your own personal story of how you have witnessed or been victimized by religious prejudice, and how, having seen it or experienced it, you don't want it to happen to anybody else, and you commit to standing up against it. How do you tell a story that weaves that history, that personal dimension, in with the theological dimension of why you, as a Catholic, look to Nostra Aetate as your theological inspiration for interfaith cooperation, why you as a Jew look to Abraham Joshua Heschel, why you as a Muslim might quote from a letter that Imam Ali sent to his governor in Egypt. You will find those there who are your brothers and sisters in faith, and others who are your equals in creation. In all of our traditions, there is what I call a theology of interfaith cooperation. The ability to weave that in to a public narrative of why interfaith cooperation is significant, I think is a paramount skill for interfaith leadership. Skill number two, how do you create activities that people who orient around religion differently can come together and do powerfully with one another? I love to talk about Habitat for Humanity here because lots of folks know of Habitat for Humanity as an organization dedicated to ending poverty housing. But it was actually started with a twin mission, and the poverty housing one was only the first. The second mission was what Millard Fuller liked to call the theology of the hammer. Millard Fuller, the founder of Habitat for Humanity, was heartbroken that members of his own Christian community, Pentecostals and Presbyterians, couldn't be in the same room talking Jesus together. They yelled at each other too much. Too many differences on that. Differences about how the pastor should dress. Differences about what time church should start. But you know what they agreed upon? The importance of serving others. So Millard Fuller creates Habitat for Humanity as an activity that convenes people from across the Christian spectrum to connect their faith to service and to connect to one another. Well, if it's good enough for Pentecostals and Presbyterians, it's good enough for Muslims and Jews. At least that's what we thought at Interfaith Youth Corps when we adopted that model wholesale. There are a million things that people from different religions are going to disagree on. There are a million activities that you could create that people from different religions will come together and only yell at each other about. How do you curate activities that are convening activities, that inspire people to work together and share stories where they learn from one another, where they leave and they say, man, I didn't know that there was such a rich service tradition in Jainism. I didn't know about the notion of the bodhisattva in Buddhism, that one who attains enlightenment can choose to return to earth and teach compassion, and that that is a vaunted figure, a vaunted position in Buddhism. I didn't know about tikkun olam in Judaism, the tradition of repairing the world. How do you create activities that bring people from these various spiritual, ethical, philosophical religions together to do something good and constructive for the world and to tee up a conversation that brings up the dimensions of mutual enrichment in various traditions rather than the dimensions of mutual exclusion?
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. Today, we heard part one of a lecture that was given by Interfaith Youth Corps founder Eboo Patel here in Grand Rapids. Please join us next week on Common Threads, and you'll hear part two. I'm Fred Stella. Thank you for joining us.